Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Rob Stuckey, Head of U.S. Real Estate here at Carlyle, and a friend and mentor to me, and the person whose judgment I trust more than any others on real estate, certainly, but really on any topic on which Rob is willing to opine. We'll discuss the investment environment in the United States with, of course, a focus on real estate and current strategies. This episode was recorded on June 10th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Rob, just a word about what we're seeing in the portfolio. I would say the portfolio data, again, those key performance indicators that are most cyclically sensitive or synchronized with the broader economy, have continued to hold up reasonably well. It looks like final demand through the first 5 months of 2025 in the US growing at about a 1.5% annual rate. Of course, there are signs of weakness. Travel spending is falling. We also observe signs of payback and equipment orders from front-loaded, that means pre-tariff purchases made in Q1. Residential construction also continues to subtract from GDP, with little in the pipeline to suggest that there's likely to be a meaningful turnaround in the near term. On the flip side, our tech spending index rose at a 9% annualized rate in May, and AI data center exposed order books registered some of their strongest growth observed in the past 3 years, which of course has been a period of fairly consistent rapid growth. Assets put in place in that space are now up about sevenfold from 2020, meaning that the same growth rates are making a progressively larger contribution to GDP. But you know, what continues to be so interesting is that we see the effect of tariffs as it relates to government coffers, but not yet the effects in terms of the underlying data, whether it be prices, activity, production schedules, employment markets, et cetera. So it looks like the US government collected almost $30 billion in tariffs in May. That's up threefold from year ago levels. But we do not see an increase in the price level commensurate with that. Certainly there's been some pass-through to goods prices. We saw more of that in May than we did in April. But some deflation in services largely offset those increases, with prices for transportation, warehousing, and construction softening modestly in May. And of course, prices paid for energy are still down meaningfully relative to year ago levels. So, you know, I still think it's a situation where many management teams and of course investors still continue to be of the view that this tariff schedule that exists today is not going to be the one that is in place a few months from now, and therefore don't want to do anything rash or hasty, and just want to let things play out, continue to draw down inventories acquired prior to tariffs, keep things more or less normal, but we'll ultimately have to come to terms with the fact that the administration seems to be very intent on continuing to generate this revenue from tariffs. Through May, it looks like tariffs are now generating revenue equal to about 0.7% of GDP. The administration is very clearly signaling to lawmakers on Capitol Hill that when they're evaluating the one big beautiful bill, the reconciliation package, and its increase in debt and deficits over the next 10 years, that they should be aware that the administration intends to more than offset any increase in debt and deficits associated with this package with tariffs and with it associated revenue. It's something that I think over the next few months, it will be very interesting as more decision makers in the economy become convinced, perhaps, that these tariffs are going to remain in place for some time to come. We will, in those coming months, perhaps see more of the effects of those tariffs manifest themselves, not just in prices, but of course also in production schedules, labor demand, and other variables. So with that, I wanted to turn things over to Rob. Rob, I just wanted to start with a broad question about the investment environment. This has been a really remarkable year when you think about the volatility that we experienced in April. It seemed that markets for 5 or 6 days were preparing themselves for a really disastrous economic outcome. And the rebound since then has been, I think, far beyond what anyone could have expected. How have you been interpreting this wild ride that we've been on from a broader market perspective?
I think we're in a period where there's quite possibly an underpricing of volatility, with credit spreads relatively tight, and with the VIX at the lowest level since Liberation Day, now at about 17, the possibility that the market's underappreciating volatility. Volatility hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. As you mentioned, tariff policies are unpredictable, and there are potential unintended consequences as well. So during times of low volatility, an investor needs to be vigilant. And a point of orientation toward being vigilant is monitoring capital expenditures. Generally, an investor wants to be investing in a sector that doesn't experience chronic CapEx, and generally want to invest in a manner that outpaces inflation, which means you need to invest in pockets of the economy that are underserved. And those are pockets that experience barriers to entry, and by implication, low CapEx. There's the possibility, maybe the probability, that volatility is underpriced.
Speaking specifically about real estate, as I mentioned at the outset, we look at material sales, materials orders, and those that are generally highly correlated with fixed residential investment. We then derive estimates from that about the direction. And right now, it looks to be contracting. So you're down, the level entering this quarter was down about 15% from those pandemic era highs. So down 15% and now contracting on a sequential basis. What's the outlook for residential investment? Because it's already a market, and you can see in the policy discussions, there's just a broad sense that the market's undersupplied, but yet it seems to be getting more undersupplied right now.
Yeah, we believe there's a chronic shortage of housing. Single-family housing permits are down 4% year over year. Multifamily starts are down at least 30%. So supply is decelerating sharply. There was a peak in supply deliveries in early 2024, first half of 2024. And we expect there to be significant fall-off of deliveries in 2026. And we think this provides a tailwind for rent growth in the housing sectors. It's notable that housing represents about a third of the CPI index, and so it could produce some stickiness in how inflation is calculated.
The spring season, there were very high expectations for existing home sales, perhaps new home sales as well. And, you know, whether it's mortgage rates or whether it's tariffs and concerns about employment going forward, expectations have been dashed. And I know a topic that has been a focus of yours is, it's just really at the current price level for housing and accounting for the current level of mortgage interest rates, that would seem in and of itself, even leaving these supply issues, to create an affordability problem that also should support rents on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, I think that affordability is the primary constraint for new starts of single family. And there's another factor, which is rental housing is about $1,000 per month cheaper than owning a home. And as a consequence, multifamily and other forms of rental housing are capturing more share. So for those reasons, there continues to be sort of a ceiling on new starts of single family.
On a geographic basis, of course, there was this period of really enormous internal migration during the pandemic, its immediate aftermath. Where are we right now in terms of internal migration, and what sorts of markets are having the most attractive underlying fundamentals right now, in your opinion?
In the aftermath of COVID, the Sun Belt benefited greatly as people had more flexibility where they lived and worked. And as a consequence, Florida and Texas were recipients of internal migration. Recently, that's leveled off, and growth in Florida, for example, has slowed down. There's another factor, which is just the cost of living in states that have high taxation, and that's become more relevant to people who have choices. And one thing that COVID did was it gave people choices as to where they live.
I wanted to turn to the data center boom. And this is something that when you situate it historically, there are a lot of echoes of the late 90s, in my opinion. At that time, the technological shock, of course, was the internet. And there was a sense at the time that the places to invest were those key bottlenecks related to hardware. So, of course, that was routers, switching. You saw the huge increase in the market capitalization of companies like Cisco and telecom equipment manufacturers, but then just really enormous fixed investment, demand for their products, surging order books. And then, of course, there came the realization that there was quite significant overbuilding and a lengthy hangover. So, you know, again, that template doesn't seem so unreasonable in terms of expectations for where we are with data centers, but yet each month when we look at the data, when we look at, you know, what we have in the portfolio that's exposed to the hardware, to the infrastructure, to the applications, very rarely has there been any reduction or deceleration in the trend growth rate we're estimating. You have annually compounded growth, depending on where you look, that's between 35 to 60% from progressively higher levels, you know, relative to a year ago. How long do you think that this can sustain itself?
It's interesting that you compare it to the tech telecom meltdown to 2000-2001. Assumption that is made was made then and is probably being made now is that the trend growth rate will continue and that the pace of supply delivery will continue. Currently, there's a race between demand and supply. And generally, when there's this much capital allocated to a sector, supply ultimately wins that race. It's just a question of when. And when supply wins, investors lose. And I think that's quite likely here. It's hard to comment on whether the trend on the demand side is sustainable and a normalized level. You still have this question on supply. And I think it's really important to identify where the supply constraint is right now. The choke point is the delivery of power, not the delivery of the actual buildings. And so that's an important distinction because then you need to think about how power will be delivered and how the supply imbalance will be resolved. And the chunks by and quantum of delivery of power could be quite large relative to the base, which could mean that there could be a sudden resolution of the supply constraint, and that would result in a drop in rents. So there's that possibility, namely nuclear power plants, as well as the possibility of technological change in supply. And we saw that momentarily with the threat of DeepSeek offering potential, effectively, changes in requirements in a significant way. So I think there are risks with the data center boom. I think there's a wide range of outcomes. I think that's really where we need to leave it, is that we need to acknowledge there's a wide range of possible outcomes. And anytime you combine a wide range of outcomes with high CapEx, there's a significant risk that may not justify the corresponding return.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because we talk so much about cyclicality, or at least GDP dependence, and that's where the risks are in real estate, is as you've explained to me. And this is just an interesting dynamic because it's so disconnected. Now, of course, it's making a larger and larger contribution to GDP. So it's kind of creating its own space and it's becoming cyclically sensitized just because it's becoming so large as a share of the economy. But it is this exogenous shock. So it has that kind of non-correlation, but these really unpredictable and interesting dynamics.
I think there are two factors that drive cyclicality. One is the macro trend line. We'll say GDP is the best proxy for that, and there's a range of outcomes associated with that, but also CapEx. And some sectors are capital intensive, and those sectors tend to experience amplification to the cyclicality. The other thing with data centers is that what's being built is an accommodation to the cloud, which is also termed as hyperscalers, and that's commodity space. And so when supply resolves the imbalance, the commodity space will experience rent reductions, significant adjustment to rent. By contrast, when we were substantial owners of a company called CoreSite, it was a network dense data center company which had differentiation because it catered to tenants that were performance sensitive and benefited from an ecosystem. So there is a bifurcation within the data center sector between commodity and network dense ecosystems.
I do want to ask quickly about office. Of course, you famously avoided office exposure because of your framework, not any antipathy towards office itself, but of course your investment framework found that these properties essentially ran afoul of it for multiple reasons. I think all three or all four of the factors. But where are we today and how have things played out? Just as an observer of commercial real estate, not exposed in your portfolios, but just observing the market trends, how have things played out perhaps relative to expectations? It seems that we do see more 5 days in the week in the office. There seems to have been, you know, the local tax receipts have not fallen to the extent that many people feared. There's more retail. The central business districts seem to be doing perhaps a bit better, or at least relative to some of the most pessimistic forecasts. Where do you see that market right now?
Well, I think the general answer is that pre-COVID, national occupancy rates were, say, 92%. And during COVID, they fell to 78%. And they're about halfway back nationally, with some markets like Manhattan nearly all the way back. But still, there's an underlying risk with the sector. And it gets to what you mentioned earlier, which is our structural analysis of sectors. And we look at five factors. One of them is correlation to GDP. And of course, the office sector is highly correlated to GDP. Another is operating margins giving full effect to CapEx, because landlords persistently pursue tenants with high capital improvements to induce them to lease a space. And it's a losing game. Another factor is technology. Technology serves as a headwind because it creates some degree of functional obsolescence for office. Just the fact that you're able to effectively go to the office by logging in on Zoom is an example of technology working against the office space as an accommodation. And then finally, just average length of stay of the underlying tenant base is short relative to the capital required to procure the tenants. And so it's fundamentally a very difficult sector, and those fundamentals haven't changed.
Yeah. Finally, I just want to ask, when you hear industrial, most people are thinking about warehouses, you know, thinking about logistics. And of course, that leads to this idea of reindustrialization. Of course, reindustrialization has been a real phenomenon. It has been multiple years. I think much of it was just the lessons from the pandemic, you know, realizing that just-in-time inventories engineered to minimize costs could actually maximize losses during periods where there's, you know, shutdowns or difficulties securing necessary supplies. Where are we with regard to industrialization, warehouses, and some of the other logistics markets?
The industrial sector benefits from two structural shifts. As you mentioned, reindustrialization leads to onshoring, which creates a requirement for more industrial floor space than in the past. And another factor is technology in the form of e-commerce, which has shifted demand from bricks and mortar retail to industrial fulfillment centers. And e-commerce adoption has increased from about 20% to about 30% in 2030. And that increasing adoption is going to occur irrespective of whether there's a recession. So that aspect of demand is unsystematic. In other words, it's not correlated with GDP. So we have these two structural factors that are A, driving demand, and B, creating less systematic risk. So we like the sector. There's been some softness in the sector in the last year and a half, but that's primarily due to supply, a little bit of pullback in demand. But the markets that are more infill and serve population density really benefit from this e-commerce trend, and that will continue.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, for joining me today.
Thank you, Jason.
And I also wanted to congratulate you on being included in Commercial Observer's 2025 ranking of the most powerful players in commercial real estate. Very well deserved, of course.
Well, as you know, I don't like calling attention to myself, but I'll accept it nonetheless.
Well, I'm always happy to call attention to you, and thank you so much for all you've taught me over the years. And thank you to our audience for listening, and I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of insights and indicators.